Call the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are.
It's a serious question.
I appreciate your passion. I share it. I've addressed this question. I've addressed my personal feelings.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news.
You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, and welcome back. It's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. With us today, as usual, is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and CQ Roll Call editor-at-large, bon vivant, John Bennett.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth. With Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not released anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
And we're here to talk about what's gone on this past week. And I guess let's start out with the biggest news of the day. And that is, of course, that Ron Klain, the chief of staff of Biden's White House, is leaving to be replaced by Jeffrey Zients, who was headed off the COVID response. We've seen him in the briefing room on a couple of occasions. Ron Klain is the architect, everyone surmises, of the Biden communication strategy, as well as many of the other strategies employed by the White House. So his leaving after the State of the Union leaves many to wonder if there's going to be a big change of direction in the way that Biden handles the press and the rest of the world. So, John, I'll start with you. How do you see this as a move for the White House?
Overall, I think this is a move that makes a lot of sense for Joe Biden. I think bringing Zients in is a logical, second chief of staff for a Democratic president. Zients has been an acting OMB, Office of Management and Budget Director. He was on President Obama's White House Economic Council. He was the COVID czar. He's been back in the White House since sometime in the fall. They brought him back in. It seems as if they brought him in to prepare for this very move. He was helping with staff turnover, but some reports today indicate that Ron Klain had given him some bigger projects, and folks in the West Wing viewed that as kind of a tryout, getting his feet wet. They were very chiefy tasks that Zients took over. So it makes sense. He knows how Washington works. He knows how the chief of staff's job is really to harness everything and organize it and make it work. And somebody like Zients is perfect for that. Now, they do play the games, as they say. On paper, this looks good, but he's going to have a big job, from dealing with a Republican House to the situation in Ukraine, battling the Pentagon wants to do this, but the State Department wants to do something else vis-a-vis Ukraine, and the intelligence community wants to do a third thing. So that's just an example. Of course, on domestic policy, COVID's still out there. There's still a lot to do there. They still have a domestic agenda. So it makes sense. The last thing, and not trying to filibuster here, but the last thing you do wonder, though, is with the classified document scandal now hanging over the White House, more documents, it was revealed last night, found at the president's Wilmington, Delaware area home. You do have to wonder if Klain's departure was sped up because of the scandal. Maybe the plan was to leave. This will come out in reporting, I'm sure. Maybe the plan was to leave, in the spring. But somebody, I do really feel like a scandal like this not so much that Biden has documents or had documents from his Senate days or his days as vice president. They didn't disclose this. They knew this a few days before the midterm elections, and Klain would have been in the room for that conversation. And
he probably orchestrated it, isn't
right?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a terrible look, despite what White House officials say. They might have been transparent with DOJ and the archivist, but they were not honest with the American people before the election. They knew about this, and they were still arguing about Trump. They didn't want documents, right?
They didn't want to screw up their chances in the midterm.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. And this is the way Washington works. When there's a scandal like this, somebody's got to go. It's not going to be the president. So you do wonder if the plan was for Klain to step off the ship, but now he was kind of pushed.
Michael, what do you think, looking from the outside, as you look into it, do you think it speaks well for the Biden administration, or it tells us that there's chaos ensuing?
I think that the chief of staff job is a very difficult job. And it's a rare chief of staff that lasts very long in that job because of the toll it takes. And I think that Ron Klain gave 2 years to Biden. He's given a lot of his entire career to Biden.
Yes.
And I think it makes sense.
And they're close friends.
For him and his family to make this change. You know, you're going to be switching into campaign mode soon if Biden announces that he's going to run. And I expect that Klain will have a role to play in that. He's always been the person who prepares candidates for the debates and the like and setting the strategic agenda. So I think that probably this is the timing that was set in motion some time ago, and that the Biden documents case probably is not relevant to it. And there's no way of knowing that, but because of their deep years of friendship between Biden and Klain, I can't see him having been pushed out. Maybe the timetable moved up a little bit to coincide with the new Congress and this burgeoning political, you know, dust up about the documents. But I do think that Klain has just served his time and is now himself and Biden in agreement, ready to move on.
I'm going to strike a middle ground on all of this. I think both of you make excellent points, but I don't think there's any way that you can't look at the Biden administration and not see Ron Klain's fingerprints on everything that's gone on inside the White House. And while there's little fallout, and we'll talk a little bit more about the in a second about the Biden so-called scandal with the classified documents. But when you look at that, there's no real, I think they were protecting themselves from, they were, as you said, John, transparent with the DOJ, which protects them from any sort of prosecution or criminal problems. But it's the political fallout from it that they seem to have gone over, or have glossed over. And I, time and again, it's been Ron Klain who has been the architect of the communication strategy of the White House. And I think that at the end of the day, they need someone with a little better ability to facilitate a better communication strategy, because I've got to tell you, out of all, and this includes Trump, out of all the administrations I've covered, this one is far and away one of the worst when it comes to strategizing with and dealing with the press. They've been extremely hands off, and it hasn't helped them. And this is all part of Ron Klain's strategy. We all know that. And the fact is, they've done some really decent, great things that they have not trumpeted themselves well on. They haven't positioned themselves well on. So I think that I don't think that Ron Klain was forced out. I think he, if anything, you're right, Michael. I think it was and John, you said it as well. Maybe the timetable was sped up a bit with the current problems. But I do believe that the part of the problem is, and I think they'll try to make political pay out of it is that, you know, with Ron Klain gone, you could say, look, that was, you know, the president going, we got rid of the problem. Let's, you know, and he'll fall on his sword for that, because at the end of the day, he's still going to be there for Biden. He's a long-term friend. He'll help him out in any strategy that he needs, or preparing him, as Michael said, for re-election. But with him out of the White House, it gives the White House the chance to move on from Klain and attribute its poor messaging and poor communication to Klain, for what it's worth. That's where I fall on it.
Yeah, and I guess the one question I would ask is, when you say poor messaging, I hear that as saying they weren't as forthcoming with the press as other administrations have been.
I think it's strategy, how they strategize and how they deal with the press. It's their overall strategy towards the press and towards the American public that I find difficult to deal with. I mean, Trump was just a bully and was out there in your face all day long. The Biden administration has hidden Joe Biden when Joe Biden is the best one to communicate the strategy of the White House. And I've told them this on a number of occasions in the White House. I've told every press secretary this. They are not as good at, and we've discussed this here, no one is as good as Biden is at discussing the strategy of the White House. They need to have him there more often. Their fear is that he'll gaffe. But John, you and I both know from covering Biden for many years, that's Joe. So that's going to happen. And he's nowhere near as bad as Donald Trump. He's not going to attribute, you know, COVID, saying you could fix COVID by injecting bleach and sunlight. I mean, he's just going to make the gaffes that he makes. He just does on occasion. Fine. But I think, you know, on some of the key issues where the Democrats have done very well, their messaging has been poor. And that, I think, lies at the feet of the outgoing Chief of Staff Ron Klain. John, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I'll ask you, but I'll answer my own question first, which is a fun trick. Do you think that the comms will get better? I don't either. and you remember, Kate Bedingfeld, the communications director, was going to leave. She stuck around a little longer. She's still there. So
Spoke with her, she wasn't going anywhere. That was a couple of weeks ago, so, and I asked her.
I don't really see the communications strategy changing all that much just because the chief is leaving. I could be wrong about that. We saw changes in the Trump White House, and of course,
nothing changed.
I didn't cover the Obama White House. I only had one press secretary, one comms director, when I covered that. So, you know, but it does take on the personality, I think the communications director as much as the chief.
Yeah. But with this, I'll say this, and that's maybe where Zients will have an influence. I don't know that the communications, that we see out of the White House will change much, but the appearance will be that it does, and it'll give the White House, well, that's the way it used to be. We're being more open with the press now, especially regarding, you know, the fact that they didn't disclose the classified documents until well after they had disclosed it to the DOJ. They can lay that at the feet of Ron Klain quite easily. And it doesn't mean that anything will improve in the White House. It just means that they'll say it has improved. Mm-hmm. But whether it does or not is questionable. It does take on the usually the personality of the guy in charge, but I would love to see this as a change in how the White House staff communicates with the press. But they are very young, very malleable, and I don't think it will either, but we'll wait and see.
So I think all of this, one of the answers should be that they bring John Kirby into the White House as the press secretary.
But I don't think that'll happen.
Yeah, I think he's as good as they come.
And John is very forthcoming, very honest, and a very easy guy to talk to, straight shooter. But yeah. John, you and I both have talked about this. I don't think that'll happen.
Yeah, I've known Kirby for a long time from covering the Pentagon. I remember when he didn't have any stars on his shoulders. That's how long I've known Kirby. Yeah, he's a straight shooter. He's just a pro. He's just a pro. Nice guy. You know, we've had some heated back and forths at times over the years. And then the next time I saw him, you know, he smacked me on the shoulder and, you know, asked me, you know, just how I was doing. It's just kind of the guy he is. And he is honest. I don't know if that's the personality of this communication shop. Again, I don't know if Bedingfeld would sign off on that. But that said, they did bring him over. They did bring him over into the NSC, at least the National Security Council. John doesn't want to get political, though, and he would have to stand at the podium, the lectern, sorry, the lectern. He would have to stand at the lectern every day and
deal with and politics. Say things.
Yeah, he would have to go hard at Republicans, harder than he does now, a lot harder than he does now. That's part of the press secretary job. I just don't know if he wants to do that.
I know he does. He's not real sure. Last I spoke with him, he still wasn't really sure what his true role was, but he's trying to feel it out. And I, as you do, get the feeling that he's more comfortable, you know, pinch hitting rather than being at cleanup in the lineup. So yeah. Moving on, let's talk a little bit about the Biden's classified issue problem. And Michael, I'll start with you because I think, look, explaining this to, I don't think the press has done a very good job explaining this issue to the American people. Did Joe Biden have classified documents? Yes. Did he turn them over? Yes. Did he ever claim that they were his and stonewall the DOJ as they tried to search and lie about having them? No, he did not. So explain in a nutshell, if you can, the difference between the Biden case and the Trump case so that people understand.
So the similarities between them are that they are people who possessed documents which had classified markings on them outside of the secured facilities. That's a violation of the rules regarding classified documents. They're not allowed to go outside of these facilities. So the similarity is at the threshold level, they both appear to have mishandled classified documents. That's where the common ground stops. The problem that Trump has is that once these mishandled documents were identified and asked to be returned, he refused to do that and may have indeed obstructed the requests by DOJ to get them back, whereas Biden fully cooperated and returned those documents.
And found them himself first and then gave them to him.
Found some of them first.
Yeah.
Well, I said to somebody once when they were asking me to analogize this, I said, you've got two cars who are speeding down the highway. Both of them are speeding. One gets pulled over for speeding and asks for his license and registration. He says, absolutely, and hands it over. The other one is speeding down the highway, careening off of cars and engaged in reckless driving and property damage. He gets pulled over and gets arrested for resisting the officer's efforts to get his license and registration. To me, that poses an, you know, inept maybe, but useful analogy in that you've got two cars that are speeding, but one is engaged in reckless driving and is failing to cooperate with the police. The other one just was speeding and cooperated. And judges handling those two cases will treat them very differently, even though they both have a common touch point of speeding. And I think that were Trump to have given back the documents immediately, even though he appears to have taken some of them potentially intentionally, the North Korea letters in particular, I think this thing would be long ago dead and buried, because I think that in my experience, most people who have been in the senior positions in government for a long time have inadvertently possessed classified documents. We classify way too many things, and you move out of these positions, you know, sort of in a very hurried way. And I think mistakes happen. I remember during my independent counsel investigation, I interviewed George Herbert Walker Bush. He was then the former President Bush. And I asked him a question. We asked him a question during the deposition. Does he remember a conversation with Secretary Baker about something? And he said, you know, I don't know, but let me go check my diary. And he checked his diary and he gave us his answer. Well, if he's got a diary, his personal diary, that has communications between himself and the former Secretary of State, maybe those are classified communications that shouldn't be residing in his office. I don't know. I'm not accusing him of anything wrongdoing. I liked him quite a lot. He was quite a gentleman. But all I'm saying is mistakes happen. The question is what happens after the mistake is discovered. And you know, they always say, you know, it's not the crime, it's the cover up. And yeah. that's where these cases diverge.
And John, let's without putting my own taint on it, how do you think the press has handled the coverage of these two different issues?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've done a decent job without knowing yet what the contents of most of the Biden documents are. I think, you know, we can't let our foot off the gas, because the scandal for Biden isn't that he had some documents, you know, and you know, from covering national security for so many years, you know, a handful of times a general or an undersecretary was presenting at a conference and there was a murmur in the crowd and someone pointed at his slide on the big screen and it said classified. A classified slide got into an unclassified public PowerPoint presentation, and the general panics and says, next slide, next slide, next slide. Or, you know, there was a time or two I was meeting with a source and they're, you know, presenting me some documents, some things that I might for my reporting. And the guy looks down and panics and grabs them off the table at lunch or something and says, oh, I can't give you that one. That one's classified. I didn't mean to bring that. It got mixed in. So this happens. In the Biden case, the scandal isn't that he had 30 documents from a 50-year career. The scandal is that they didn't tell us before the midterm election, an election that changed control of the House. And we don't know. We don't know what would have happened if they would have told us this a couple days before the election. Democrats kept the Senate, but it wasn't by much. This could have changed Senate control. We just don't know. That's the scandal for Biden. In Trump's case, the scandal is the amount of documents that he had. As Michael said, that he took some of them on very much on purpose and then lied about it, refusal to give them back, and then, of course, refused to cooperate. How is the press done in explaining all that? You know, I think some days we do a pretty good job. Some days it's a little lacking, but I think there is some benefit of the doubt giving to Biden here. I do think he's earned some of that over the years, but we have to continue holding them accountable. That's the question that I hope gets asked over and over again, is why didn't you disclose this to the public before people voted?
I agree with but I will say that we've done, I think, done a piss poor job of explaining the differences between the two cases, because the Republicans continue to frame the argument. The Democrats continue to react to the frame that the Republicans have put up in false comparisons of the two. And we report the two without explaining the differences, as Michael explained. So for me, the biggest fault I have with the press at this point is that we're not framing the argument. We're not telling people what the differences are. What we're doing is accepting the Republican claim that, you know, oh, these are two scandals. These are equal almost in their scan. And, you know, you've got Jim Jordan going, when are we going to, you know, answer subpoenas? I don't know, Jim, when are you going to answer a subpoena? You know, we've got the Republicans on their high horse and we follow along and ask the questions. The briefing room question that should be asked time and again is the one you've mentioned here so cogently is why? Now, we all know the reason why. The reason why is because of the political fallout. There is no, and Michael, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't see any criminal or prosecutorial fallout. They were open and honest with the DOJ. How they chose to take care of it politically is the question that you ask Biden. With Trump, the question you ask him is, again, why won't you give me your license and registration? Why the hell are you denying that you were speeding? And why, you know, why did you take off on purpose? I mean, I like the analogy between two speeders because it kind of gives you the idea of the nature of the case. But I think in our case with the press, it's been pathetic that we buy into how the Republicans or even the Democrats frame the argument. We need to be as blunt about it and as honest about it as you have been, John, right now, just saying, look, here's the question, damn it. Why the hell didn't you tell us sooner? And I have yet to hear that enunciated bluntly and clearly in the briefing room. And I apologize for not being there to do it myself.
So may I just say one thing, which is wearing my lawyer hat.
Wear it, baby.
Generally speaking, in the midst of an ongoing investigation, you do not want your client speaking publicly about what's going on. Generally speaking, that doesn't help. Look at Michael Cohen. It just doesn't help. The problem here is that he's a political official and the media is just relentless in asking for answers to questions that probably the DOJ wouldn't have wanted him to answer in the first place. If you take, for example, the search of his house that occurred on Friday, DOJ did ask Biden not to reveal the fact that there was a search ongoing until it was completed and everything was returned to the DOJ sometime on Saturday. And so they honored that agreement. But I'm sure someone somewhere is asking, well, why didn't you tell us that on Friday when this was ongoing? So we could be there.
Republicans have done that.
Yeah. Well, so that we could be there and be asking the DOJ and the FBI and whomever of the search party what was going on. And the answer is because we didn't want you there. We want to do our search uninterfered with by these types of questions because they don't help us resolve whether or not there is a criminal case here. And so I think Biden has that problem, which is the DOJ is speaking with his lawyers, who are very good lawyers, Bauer and Sauber, and they're most likely saying to him, it would be our preference for you not to talk about this. And so, you know, if you honor that request, then you get, you know, stuck in this bind that you guys are pointing out, which is that it appears as if he was purposefully hiding something for political purpose. Now, I have no way of knowing whether or not revealing that there was an ongoing issue around classified documents would have changed anything in any state with respect to the Senate. It's unknowable to me.
It is.
Maybe there was an obligation to be forthcoming, but if you're looking at it from a legal perspective, your interest is making sure that at the end of the day, your client is found not criminally responsible. And if you have to take short-term political hits, like why didn't you tell us on November 2nd, then you take those hits and you say at the end of the process, I'm sorry I wasn't more forthcoming. I wasn't because the DOJ asked me not to be. I'm pleased that the DOJ has found, as I said, there was no there there. And now let's get on with the work of the American people. I would prefer that to what I thought was a fumbled press conference when Biden was sort of reading from a notebook about there being nothing there and that he was listening to his lawyers. I thought that message wasn't, he wasn't looking up, he was looking at his book. I just thought that was bad. optically and as a matter of messaging. So I just assume have him out of public view until this thing is settled, and just take the hits from the Jim Jordans. And as you properly point out, Brian, that Jim Jordan, a person who defied a congressional subpoena and is pending a complaint before the Ethics Committee, has no business calling anybody anything when it comes to compliance.
Yes, and he needs to wear long shirts. But that's John, your thoughts on that? Because I do have some to come back with, Michael, but I wanted to hear what John thought first.
Well, I think that it's a problem that they didn't tell us before the election. And, you know, Republicans are gonna keep hammering that home. I think there was a way to do exactly what Michael's describing, that he would advise a client, is there's a way to do that, to not talk about it too much publicly, but also alert voters that we found these documents, that this happened. I think you can do both things. These are smart folks over there. They could have figured out a way to do that, you know, but including because Joe Biden said he would never lie to the people. Now, I'm not saying Joe Biden lied here, but he wasn't completely truthful right before an election. And I know he's a politician. I get it. But yeah, it's going to hang over them. And it just gives Republicans another attack line. And, you know, this morning, James Comer, who is the chairman of the House Oversight and Accountability Committee. He's looking hard at the Biden family business dealings, the think tank, the Biden Center at University of Pennsylvania. He's looking at the funding there. They're already, without showing us a shred of evidence, but remember, they don't need evidence. This is not a criminal court that they're presiding in. This is a political court. They're trying to disqualify Joe Biden from a second term, and they're already tying all of this to China. I don't know how many times Comer said Chinese Communist Party this morning. He was on Fox News. And, you know, he's revealing.
He has no credibility either, but
it doesn't matter.
But see, that's where, all right, I'll again, Michael, I'm going to put on my reporter's hat for a second and say, you know, we should be told what's going on, when it's going on, and not have information withheld from us. So when there is a, this is why I've stood up in court and asked that court proceedings not be closed. This is why we fight so hard with freedom of information requests. The fact of the matter is the DOJ, we don't know what they're doing, or if they allow, they give themselves little cover and open up the book for people to say that they're manipulated when they do things in secret. There's a way for them to say, this is what we're doing, that we're not going to tell you this, we're going to tell you that. Here's the search warrant. It's part of the public record. Bingo. Fine. And leave the rest of it to us. I don't think it helps anyone to hide stuff and then allow stories to be built up around it, speaking to your point, John. But the bottom line is, for the press, we still screwed the pooch, because there is a vast difference between the two cases, and we don't do a very good job. Let the Republicans try to make hay out of it. But if the facts are known, and look, these will come up in these hearings and will mean little to the Republicans who are going to pursue, like Jim Jordan does, his own interest against logic and against the facts that, you know, he's not, as Michael said, he's not come forward to answer a congressional subpoena. He's going to use the facts and manipulate them to benefit himself. Fine. But if we do a better job, and so I guess I fall in criticizing both the Democrats and Republicans and the DOJ. If we did a better job defining what the facts are and allowing the American people to know what's really going on, the Republicans would have less ability to manipulate those facts. The Democrats, in this case, would be better off for them, but the American public would be better off, because personally, the animus that exists over this issue drives me bonkers, after having covered and knowing full well what Donald Trump is and was, and knowing what Biden is and was. There's no comparison between the two, and we're drawing false analogies. That's my thought anyway. So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, well, we talked about, you know, some of those committee assignments. We're going to talk about that and the war in Ukraine and a little bit more. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you, and we need your help. Seriously. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQpodcast. to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.
We are back. It's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Kerman. With me again is John Bennett from CQ Roll Call, former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin. And we've been talking a little bit about what's been going on this week. And I guess the committee assignments, Michael, you brought that up in our pregame. Some of the committee assignments that have been assigned to the Republicans in the House have certainly given us cause for concern. You want to start out with what your biggest concern is from it?
Well, I have to say I'm very happy that Santos has been on Science and Technology Committee, given his multiple Nobel Prizes in science, which I read on his bio. Kidding aside, what's troublesome, McCarthy has the right as the speaker to put anyone he wants on whatever committee he wants. But what strikes me when you see how many MAGA people were put on oversight and Homeland Security, and how many sort of MAGA freshmen sort of jumped the line above more moderate, more long in tenure members, you realize what a Faustian deal McCarthy made in order to become speaker. And I think that it will have long-term implications for the Republican Party. I think that when you start manipulating committee assignments as blatantly as he did in order for him to assume power, it's just a bad look. It invites cynicism. And that is what I'm opposed to most, because we can't afford more cynicism about our political processes. We need to dial that back. But then individually, case by case, some of the people, and you know their names better than me, but the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Scott Perrys and the Louis Gohmert, the committees that they're on, they really don't come to those committees with, I think, the entitlement to be on those committees. And I find it troubling. Now, that said, of course, if you sit in their seat and you look at the committee assignments from their perspective and you think, well, you've got Eric Swalwell, you've got Adam Schiff, you've got, you know, Ted Lieu, you've got, you know, their equivalent on the other side of the aisle on all of these committees. So what's, you know, good for them is good for us. But I just think we would have been in a much better place if the outliers of each party were not running playing as an important role on these committees, that we'd be better off if those who represent the collective American will from like the 30-yard line to the 30-yard line held more power than those who are in the red zone.
John?
Yeah, I think I think my computer froze. Sorry about that.
That's all right. We're here.
That was weird. The screen went blue. And now I'm distracted. What was the where were we?
So where do you fall down in the committee assignments for the Republicans coming into and controlling the House?
Sorry about that blue screen of death. We got these committee assignments, and they were pretty shocking, as Michael laid out. We didn't know, we still don't know everything that the speaker agreed to become the speaker, but we got a better idea last week when we saw the committee assignments. It will make it difficult to cover these committees, I think. You've got Marjorie Taylor Greene on national security committees, and in 2018, she questioned whether a plane hit the Pentagon on 9/11, pushing a very right wing. I can't really tell which of several theories that she was pushing there. I think she was confused about the theories themselves, but she was out there pushing it. It'll make the whole process harder, but we also did expect some of this. It wasn't a huge surprise. It was a surprise, how many of the MAGA folks ended up on oversight and some of the National Security Committee, judiciaries, and other. And it may, it will make, let's say that James Comer or Jim Jordan wanted to do a very serious, thorough, by the book investigation. It's going to make that harder. It'll make the hearings more MAGA and less serious, if you will. And I think that's a problem for Republicans. It'll make, because let's be honest here. David Winston, who's a columnist for Roll Call and a political strategist, has a report out. This is all about independent voters. This is about moving these investigations are trying to move independent voters who might have voted for Trump and maybe usually vote Republican in congressional elections, but a large number of independents in November voted for Democratic candidates. And they voted for Joe Biden in 2020. This is all about trying to move some of them, plant doubts in their minds about Biden and Democrats, and move them back in the red column in 2024. And I think having some of these MAGA folks on these committees independent voters will notice that. It'll hurt the credibility of these investigations and whatever they find or whatever they claim they're finding about Joe Biden and Chinese money to the Biden Center and Hunter's laptop and Hunter's business dealings. I think it puts a big dent in their credibility.
I think the biggest thing to take away from it for all of us to consider is that 11 out of 17 of the committees are being head up by those who denied the big lie and those who supported the insurrection. For me, the biggest problem facing us going forward is that the insurrection has been institutionalized with those now heading the committees or those who are predisposed to believing that Joe Biden somehow is not the rightful winner of the 2020 election. And I think that does not bode well for all of us. But that's just me. I want to move on now to the other big news, of course. I mean, it's always big news, but Ukraine. This week in Ukraine, you have tanks being promised to Ukraine. Germany has dragged its heels on promoting or promising tanks to Ukraine. They're talking about now an effort to rid the Crimea of Russian troops. Russia's talked about a buildup of 1.5 million troops. And at the same time, we're now training in the United States Ukrainians who can operate Patriot missile batteries. And then you've had Putin come forward and saying, look, if this drags on, and I know it's a threat by him, so he could try to win. But if the ground war drags on, it increases the chance of a nuclear confrontation. That much we know is true. But as we look at this, is the U.S. getting dragged into another Vietnam is the overall question. Michael, we'll give you the first whack at that.
Well, we're not sending boots on the ground, and so that's a Thank big God. Differentiator between Vietnam and Ukraine. And I guess it depends on how big a existential threat you believe Ukraine poses. If you believe that unless Russia is stopped at Ukraine, if they are allowed to proceed sort of to success, whatever success means, then will that embolden them to do the same in other former Soviet satellite countries, which is what Putin has said all along was his interest, that the fall of the Soviet Union, he thinks, is the greatest catastrophe of modern time. And so if that's the case, if that's his objective, then, you know, do we, you know, analogizing back to World War II, do we have to, at this very first opportunity to resist that movement, with, you know, all necessary efforts? I don't know enough to know whether or not it is in fact.
Well, we should ask George Santos, since he helped win the Battle of the Bulge.
I thought he was in the Pacific. No,
after he won the Battle of the Bulge, didn't he win the Pacific after that?
Got it. He was on Okinawa. He one of the flag?
That's right. He even hoisted the flag.
Yeah. He's not long for, just to digress for a second. we haven't talked about him except to make fun, but I can't imagine that he's not going to be indicted on wire fraud and perhaps even the money laundering charges that usually follow from wire fraud. If you spend money in furtherance of the wire fraud scheme, that, you know, you acquire money by wire fraud, then you spend that money to promote the wire fraud scheme, that's money laundering. It's a 20-year felony. I can't, having been the former chief of the money laundering section of the DOJ, I can't help but think that he's not long for Congress, and he may well be on the wrong side of it, of an indictment. But
say that again, because I'm going to use that as a pull quote. You are the former. All right, that's news there, Michael. You think he will be indicted?
Yeah, I think there's a very good chance, unless there's a deal struck that he resigns, in exchange for not being prosecuted. But if I were a prosecutor and I believe that he engaged in wire fraud, which it seems like he has. I mean, again,
explain that.
Just
how?
Well, if you acquire money by false pretenses, then that's either mail or wire fraud. You can't do that.
And how did he do that again? I mean, we know, but
a small example is the GoFundMe for the well-being of a dog, which he apparently kept the money for himself. Any time you say, and this is what Trump is under investigation for in part two around his inaugural activities, you cannot say to somebody, I am raising money for this purpose, for my legal defense fund, and then use it for something else. That you just can't do that. And it seems to me from the public reporting that Congressman Santos did exactly that while running for office, that he engaged in a scheme by which he sought money under false pretenses. And that is a crime. And the spending of those proceeds is a secondary crime, which is money laundering. You always have to be careful about saying, on the basis of what is available publicly, that you have reached a legal conclusion. It's like a doctor looking at a patient on the television and saying, well, this is my diagnosis. They can't do that. I can't diagnose his case. But it sure looks, from what's publicly available, that he's engaged in an effort to acquire money by false pretenses, probably in violation of the federal election campaign rules and in violation of the wire fraud, mail fraud, and then secondarily the money laundering laws. And that's what it looks like.
And your title there at the DOJ was head of the money laundering. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, director of the money laundering office at DOJ.
Yeah. John, well, we've gone from Ukraine to Santos real quick. What do you think? You think George is going to go down?
That was quite the pivot. It was very tank-like. So we're talking about tanks. You just turned the turret and off we went.
And I have no German blood. We're all, you know, from Belarus.
That's right.
There you go. Do I think George Santos, I think eventually, I think they'll find a way to get him out of the House of Representatives. I guess we'll get a special election in his district when that happens. You know, I don't think GOP, I don't think Republican leaders are excited about him being in their conference. McCarthy for now feels like McCarthy's hands are tied on this because House rules and everything, and Republican conference rules, it's easier to remove a member if they've been charged with a crime. And I do get the sense that that's what McCarthy is waiting to see before, you know, they might try to oust this guy by other means. If federal officials or state officials are closing in on Mr. Santos and McCarthy world has picked up on that, they're probably just going to let that happen. Excuse me, as I choke on air and let the process play out as it has with other folks who have been charged with crimes and then they were expelled from the House. I wonder if that's where we're going. Now, if he's not charged and he becomes a problem for leadership, they do have some tools at their disposal. They're just not there yet.
Yeah. Well, let's pivot back with that tank back to Ukraine and we'll talk about those tanks. You had something you wanted to say about that. Go for it.
Sure. I completely understand where the Biden administration is on this. If it's a German tank or a Belgian tank on the front, it's one thing. If Vladimir Putin's soldiers are coming home in body bags and coffins because American tanks destroyed their tank and it exploded and they died, that's a tougher thing back home for Mr. Putin if those are American tanks. I do understand that's the reluctance right now. It's what does this do to Putin at home, and how would he react to that? I think that's part of their calculus, and poorly is how Putin would react, to use just a one-word summary. And they don't want that. He would also, and then he would have to step up some of the tactics that he's used in the war. I mean, last weekend, Russian forces fired missiles at an apartment building in Ukraine. So there's a fear within the Biden administration. I think it's a very smart fear. It's a caution, and I think it's very smart because Putin could just, you know, target more and more civilian targets, and they don't want that. So that's why you see Lloyd Austin in Europe last week, pushing so hard for the Germans to send their Leopard tanks, the UK pushing Germany and other countries to send their tanks. So, you know, we don't have to send American made tanks over there because, you know, that could really escalate things. But Michael's got a point. Michael's got a very good point. And I know folks in the Biden administration and in Congress are concerned with that very thing. Not stopping Putin now could be the worst option. But at the same time, you know, they're going to try to get those German tanks in there, see if that makes a difference first before they're going to send any American tanks over there. I mean, they sent Bradleys, they sent these Stryker vehicles. I covered weapons development for years. They sent those things in part, but the U.S. Army wanted to get rid of the Stryker. They never loved the Stryker. No. They felt it was a mistake. I'm not going to say they wasted billions, but they never loved it. Yeah, they designed it, they developed it, then they got it out, and they didn't like it. So they moved on to the next thing. I think you'll see more and more. It's a way for the U.S. Army to get rid of equipment, frankly. So more Strykers, more Bradleys. Again, the Bradley fighting vehicle, not necessarily a tank. But they're playing the optics game here. And I think the caution is wise. But the question is, if you do get the German tanks and the British tanks in there and they don't make a difference, then what?
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to take another short break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about some active Marines that were charged for the January 6th insurrection. And, of course, we can't get out of this discussion without discussing the NFL and the Super Bowl. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast.
That's JATQ Podcast.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not found anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and with me again is Michael Zeldin, former DOJ prosecutor, and John Bennett, the editor-at-large at CQ Roll Call. Bon vivant, excellent columnist. While we got a shot here, guys, go ahead and plug what you want. Michael, your podcast?
Is called That Said with Michael Zeldin, and it's a podcast that based around books, not politics or law, but books that I think tell interesting stories. We did one recently on the creation of the Museum of Modern Art. We did another one about a sleeper agent who was a nuclear spy for Russia in the Second World War. Just released was my interview with Nina Totenberg about her memoir on her friendship with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So it's an eclectic list of books, but all with interesting stories to tell. So That Said with Michael Zeldin on podcast apps nationwide, worldwide.
Never find podcasts or so. John, your column and your newsletter.
That's right. Column every Friday, usually every Friday, at rollcall.com. And the newsletter, CQ Afternoon Briefing, usually hits your inbox in the 4 o'clock hour, about 3 days a week. We go to 1 day a week when Congress is on recess, and you can subscribe at CQ.com.
And with that said, we're going to go talk a little bit about one of the big issues this week also, and NPR reported on this, was, and others have as well, active duty Marines, I believe it's three active duty Marines charged for their participation in the January 6th insurrection. The speculation, of course, is that that this portends horrible things for the U.S., and we'll start with John, you first, your fallout on this.
Yeah, this has been something that the military has been concerned about, both the uniform leadership at the Pentagon and the civilian leadership. I know General Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, has talked about this. Secretary Austin himself, a former four-star general, has talked about this. And that's extremism, right-wing extremism within the ranks of each service, but predominantly from some of the inward-looking reviews they've done, especially the Marines and the Army, not so much the Navy, not so much the Air Force, but it's there in the Air Force. Of course, Miss Babbitt, who was killed, had connections to the Air Force. I believe she had served. So it's there. They're concerned about it. This is just further evidence that element is in there. They've tried to root it out. They tried to remove folks. You know, you don't always know it's there, though. It's a challenge for the military. If folks aren't on social media or in their unit expressing
these views, how do you identify them?
Yeah, it's harder to identify them. And then they pop up at the Capitol and they're carrying Nancy Pelosi's lectern or something through the rotunda as they run away from tear gas. So it's a challenge that
the military. Well, there's
a visual. Yeah. It's a challenge that the military has struggled with, and I think they'll always struggle with it because, you know, these folks are drawn to the military lifestyle. The MAGA people will tell you that they love their country more than you, and part of that is serving in the military. So the Pentagon brass, the service leaders, they know it's there. They're trying to take steps to notice it when a corporal is on social media writing certain things. They're trying to track that better. They're trying to get people to be watchdogs of each other and report that behavior. But it's always going to be there. And exactly how you root it out, I don't think you can ever completely root it out. And Brian has left the building. So, Michael, what do you think?
Yeah. Well, wait, before we get to Michael, I want to read a little of the clip. It said, a Marine who said he was waiting for Civil War II and two other active duty members of the military have been charged with participating in the riot at the U.S. Capitol. And these are in the newly filed court papers. Mika Comer, Joshua Abate, and Dodge Dan Helen, there's a name for you, Dodge Dale Helenan, were arrested this week on misdemeanor charges after their fellow Marines helped investigators identify them in footage among the pro-Trump mob on January 6, 2021, according to court papers. So there was some cooperation from active duty military. These are the only three active members of the military to be charged so far. But Michael, does it make any difference that they were charged on a misdemeanor and not a felony?
No, I don't think so. I think the overarching point is the one that John made, which is for too long, the military and also state police offices around the country have been an attractive place for people with white supremacist and other similar leanings to end up. I think it would be naive to think that the Black Lives Movement, that which they have protested, police brutality, is to be seen separate from who are police officers. That's not to criticize all police officers. There are some wonderful police officers. When I was a public defender and was a prosecutor, I worked with some terrific police officers and I have the highest regard for them. But there are some rotten apples, as we see. Just this past 2 weeks, more deaths by tasing and other use of excessive force when it wasn't necessary to subdue the individual. We need, if you look at the history of police forces, I mean, the way they arose, when they had these fugitive trade slave laws and black laws enacted, the police were there to bring runaway slaves back. I mean, that's the origin of this is all terrible. And we have to come to terms with this critically in order to really make the adjustment, which is, you know, another pet peeve I have of this attack on critical race theory by the Republicans so that people remain ignorant of the true history of our country. You never can overcome your past unless you understand it. And so the issues around these three guys is one thing, but it is just the tip of a iceberg of a much bigger problem throughout policing, both in the military and in the non-military police forces.
Do you think this is a step in the right direction, indicting them, or going to be further cause or further fire for their cause?
I'm not worried about further fire for their cause. Their cause has enough innate fire without worrying about whether we're going to somehow empower them to be even more fired up. I think if it's wrong, it's wrong. And what the obligation of the media here is to explain why it is important that these three people be held accountable for their criminal activity, and why it's important, and why this is what needs to be done, irrespective of whether or not the people who are sympathizers with them get even more agitated.
And to extend that analogy further, I would say if it's wrong, it's wrong. It should be prosecuted. And that goes for Donald Trump as well. We don't need to give him any further fuel to the fire. they bring plenty, and he should be prosecuted if he's found to be in the wrong. So that's John, you're tapping your head with a pen, but
I'm seeing if there's any brain activity.
I'm going to move on to we're going to close as we often do with our, you know, the three of us like to talk sports, but the NFL playoffs. I'm going to start by saying I really think they gave Kirk Cousins too much crap. I thought he played a great game. I don't think he's a choke artist. He hit his check down receiver. I think one day that guy's going to end up with an MVP in this league. If the Vikings could just get a defense that ranked better than 31st, they might have a chance at going further in the playoffs, and you can't blame Kirk for that. That being said, I sure hope the Cowboys are no longer with us after today. Sorry, all you Cowboy fans. And so that leaves us with, what do you think of the NFL playoffs this year? John, I'll give you the first crack at that.
Well, as we record this, the Buffalo Bills are hosting the Cincinnati Bengals. It is snowing in Buffalo, and it's a pretty cool scene. January playoff football in the snow. And then the Bengals are just pounding the ball. So this is the kind of football I can get into. Just the big boys in the trenches. It's going to be all about them today. Even though Tom Brady will tell you the best time to throw the ball is in the snow because the defense has trouble reacting. He said he always preferred playing in the snow to playing in rain. So maybe Joe
Burrow.
That's
a Bart Starr saying, man. That goes way back.
Yeah.
Tom Brady's that old. He probably played with Bart.
Yeah, I thought the Saturday drama was around Patrick Mahomes' right ankle, and the Kansas City quarterback came back in the second half. We were talking before we started about that. That's a questionable decision from Andy Reid, because you know you've got two more games to play. You can't get to the Super Bowl unless you win next week, and they're going to play Cincinnati or Buffalo. Those are two great teams, and those defenses get after quarterbacks. So we'll see if Mahomes is on the field next week. The alternative is 37-year-old Chad Henne, a career backup out of Michigan. He played okay yesterday in the second quarter. But are you really gonna play Buffalo with Chad Henne? I think I would take a 70% Patrick Mahomes, at least trot him out there, see what he's got. But you got to think about they also have to think about Mahomes beyond
right.
the next two games. He's their franchise quarterback for another decade. So
who do you predict in the Super Bowl? Who do you think would be the two in the Super Bowl?
I'm going to go with the Mahomes injury. I don't think they get out of the AFC Championship. So I'll go Buffalo and San Francisco.
Ooh, Michael, your turn.
Well, I'm a New York Giants fan. And what we did learn in the past 2 weeks is Daniel Jones is a very capable quarterback against a very mediocre pass defense team, the Minnesota Vikings. And he is not a very good quarterback against the number one rated pass defense team in the Philadelphia Eagles. That was a shellacking. Although, you know, as I said to my wife after the game, they lost the first half 28-0 and the second half 10-7. So,
hey,
you know,
not bad, right?
So if there was a third and fourth half, maybe, you know, maybe we would eke out a victory. But that was an embarrassing thumping by the Giants. But, you know, good for them. They made the playoffs. They won a round in the playoffs. And that's, as a Giants fan, something we haven't seen for a very long time. I agree with John too, though, that the putting back of Mahomes right at the beginning of the second half, even though he was begging Andy Reid to put him back in. I think Reid has to say, especially since Henne drove the ball 98 yards for a touchdown at the end of the second period, why would you say, I'm going to put Mahomes in, let's see how Henne does. And if he continues to do well, let's keep Patrick's ankle protected, because he was hopping all over the field.
Yeah.
Yesterday. And I expect that today he's in a boot, and that's not what you want. It's pretty hard to play quarterback wearing a boot.
Unless you're Brett Favre. That's yeah. So Michael.
And I don't know which teams will win today, but on Sunday the 22nd, But I do hope that the next round of games finds Buffalo winners and San Francisco winners. And I would love to see a Buffalo-San Francisco Super Bowl. Two great storylines there. Buffalo, who was in the Super Bowl for many years and never won, plus the injured player and, you know, win it for him. And then, of course, San Francisco has the quarterback who was Mr. Irrelevant, the last person chosen in the National Football League draft, leading a team to the Super Bowl. It's, you know, it's not since Kurt Warner have we seen, you know, such a
anything like that
romantic storyline. Yeah.
That's a, so I'm gonna counter the romance for a bit and just say
you're such a poop.
I know. Defense wins championships. I've gotta go with Philadelphia because of their defensive prowess. I think the Eagles will be in it, and over the 49ers. As long as the Cowboys aren't, I'm happy. AFC championship, I could take the Bills or the Bengals. Long both of them have never been there, have never won it. I mean, they've been there, but they've never won it. So I'd love to see either one of them win it. But I'll give a tip of the hat to the Bengals, depending on, you know, if they win today, no. If they lose today, no. But the Bengals I like because growing up in Louisville, that was the team we all rooted for, was the Bengals, and, you know, they've never won it. But I'd be happy if the Bills were there too, because they've never won it, and I love the Bills. So, but I just don't want to see the Cowboys at this point in time. That's all that I have. One team I can't stand, and the rest of them I could live with. So we'll go with that. So listen, guys, thanks. It's been fun as always. It's next week. Final thoughts on where we'll be. I guess next week we want to talk a little bit about the rising debt ceiling crisis, but. Do you think, and a real quick question for both of you, do you think this time next week we'll be staring at a clearer or more murky picture on the Biden classified documents scandal? John, you?
More murky.
More murky. Michael?
I think pretty much the same. I expect there may be two more searches. I mean, they may, if the FBI is searching, and remember, the interesting thing about this is that this search that occurred on Friday was not at the request of the special counsel, Robert Hur. He's not on board yet. So the person who advised the attorney general that this search should go forward is the prosecutor from Chicago, the U.S. attorney from Chicago, the Trump carryover U.S. attorney, who is still running this investigation, who ordered this search. So we may see searches of two other places that Biden held documents in. And if additional documents come up, then to John's point, it'll be murkier. If there are additional searches and there are no additional documents, and this is sort of the last of it, then I think we're going to be in a holding pattern until the prosecutors tell us what they found.
I'm going to take the middle line again, the non-romantic angle being the poop and saying, I don't think this is going to go away until after the election. And I think that as far as murky goes, I think it's going to be a steady stream of BS from now until the election from Republicans as they try to make hay out of it and the Democrats as they try to dismiss it. But we'll see.
Anyway, so John Bennett, one final thing on this comment between you and me, and not for Brian to hear us. You notice how he takes the middle ground between us all the time? He's just refuses to take a position on issues.
I never know where Brian stands on anything.
No, I know. He's just such a milquetoast.
Yeah, that's. I've got to learn to be more assertive.
You do.
Right.
Stand up for yourself, Brian.
Yeah. It's tough. I'm not used to it. Anyway, thanks, guys, for joining us. We'll catch you again next week. The name of the show is Just Ask the Question. I'm your host, Brian Karam. Thanks for joining us.